In Session with Dr. Farid Holakwi.
Good evening, welcome to In Session. I'm your host, Dr. Farid Holakwi, and I'll be with you for the next hour here on Radio Hamra. Student number to call in, 310-441-0555. You can follow me on Twitter or Instagram or like my page on Facebook to get updates on the show or suggest topics or books for the program. And the shows are uploaded at the end of each week to my SoundCloud page and podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Didn't do any shows last week, so we'll be doing some catch-up with the books of the week. So there will be two tonight that I'll go over. Before that, though, the book of the week for this week that I'll talk about on next Monday's show is The Prince by Niccolò Machiavelli. This is a very famous book, although written several hundred years ago. And so much so, I haven't read the original, which is what I'm planning to do this week. But this book, The Prince by Machiavelli, and even being Machiavellian, is a psychological trait, a negative one, of being manipulative and doing whatever it takes to get power, and doing whatever you need to maintain power. And often you'd hear about leaders throughout history who would carry this book with them, or it's in a way advice to a young prince of how to gain and maintain power. And so I thought it would be interesting to read the actual book itself. So often we terms become part of almost not really pop culture, but just conventional culture, that we use terms or words without really knowing the origins or fully understanding the origins. So I thought it'd be interesting to read it. What's often also interesting for me in picking the books of the week, almost always I haven't read them before. The first year I think I did it, many of the books I'd already read. Maybe going into the second year, some of them were also books I'd read once before. But they're all new books for me now, and so I, of course, can't know the full content. I can read about and might be familiar with the author, or can also read a bit about the book, but I still can't know the full contents. But I try to be aware of what I'm going to read, and for my own time, for the listener's time. What's also a, not necessarily challenge, but something that comes to mind is that when I'm posting the books, it obviously seems like an endorsement of the book, even though I haven't read the book. And also, that could be unfortunate, because I think it's so good to make sure we expose ourselves with people we disagree with, people who see things in a different way than us. It's actually a really unfortunate trend in our society currently, is that we are becoming more and more polarized, and social media and media in general is contributing to this, because we are reading and being exposed to news that is already aligned with what we believe. And so sometimes with the books of the week, I find that is in my mind, that most people might not even see, listen to the show. They might just see me post it, if they even see that, and assume it is an endorsement of the book itself, and it often isn't. So this is one of those books where definitely I think I would not agree with the overall message, but it is a classic and very historically significant. So just some thoughts on my thought process when I'm choosing the books and some of what I think about. But let's get to the one of the books a week. I don't know if you want to call this from 2 weeks ago or last week, but it is the first book I'll cover tonight, Against Techno-Ableism by Ashley Hsu. Against Techno-Ableism, Rethinking Who Needs Improvement. And sometimes it's interesting for me, titles of the book or terms in books that I read, autocorrect will underline them. And so Techno-Ableism was underlined in a few different places where I wrote it, showing that it's not part of the common vernacular yet. But this very fascinating book, highly recommend it. It's revolves around disability, but it involves all of us, because as the book mentions, we are all either disabled or at some point, if we live long enough, we'll experience disability. And even as she cites in the book, some disability advocates They used to call non-disabled people temporarily able-bodied, or TABs. So people who are maybe at this time able-bodied or able-bodied in certain functions, but it's temporary in the sense that for all of us, that is the case. And not only that, 15% of the current population has some form of identified disability. And again, aging itself produces disability. A huge theme that I took from the book was when we are looking at a few big themes. One, when we're looking at technology that is supposed to help and advance or improve either the life quality or just geared towards individuals who are experiencing disabilities, what is so often missing is the input and the experience and expertise of those individuals with the disabilities, which almost seems obvious. You would think that would be the most important factor as well. If I'm making something for a particular individual or in a group of individuals, that they would be consulted very, very thoroughly and be part of the production of whatever that technology is, because they're the ones that will be using it. But that we don't see this happen often with the techno-ableism or the technologies that are advanced that promote techno-ableism, that reinforce some of these notions that are part of our society that are against individuals experiencing disabilities and are very much in favor of able bodies being the bodies that matter or matter more. So that was a big theme throughout the book, looking at different advancements or what's looked at as advancements or where the money goes and how often individuals with disabilities are not considered in making those advancements that are for them. And also a very important distinction that was made clear in the book was how we even perceive disability and related to techno-ableism is the medical model, which in the medical model, we look at disability as the problem. So disability itself is a problem, and sometimes even the individuals can be viewed as the problem. However, in the social model, which is more accurate, the built environment is the problem. So if we, for example, don't have one of the classic examples of modifications that have been made and still have not been made to a enough of a degree or as universally, is a ramp or accessibility for individuals who cannot walk themselves or who will need some kind of assistance or have a wheelchair. And so the environment is the issue, not the individual. But so often we look at the individual as the problem or the disability as the problem. That's often the way that the technological advancements seem to go. And that's problematic, rather than looking at the society not including everyone, not making sure all people can have access. And we still are very far behind when it comes to making sure we keep this in mind, that there is more of a focus on the social model rather than considering or thinking that with the advancements of technology, we will have a future where there is no disability. And the whole last chapter is, in a way, a affront on that, talking about how this is not possible, and sharing the expression of certain advocates in the disability community that the future is disabled, which could be looked at in multiple ways, that the overall future is disabled as society changes, as the climate changes, as the world changes, but also for each of us, whether you are currently at a certain level of disability or not, if you live long enough, you will experience more disability in your life. So the future for all of us is disabled. So the notion that we are striving towards eliminating disability is not even possible, and also can, with it, give a notion of individuals with disabilities and how we are viewing those individuals who are alive and living and making sure we're giving their life enough value, which is sad enough to even have to say. Every life should have value, but that it can be seen, the experience of many individuals with disabilities, as that their life is not valued in the same way. And that's why advocacy is so important, and more than advocacy, making actual changes in the world. So going to go through there's a few major chapters or major themes and chapters that came up. One was even related to having prosthetics and how this is often viewed as this, easy fix and a fix, and that everyone we would think, the non-disabled community assumes, well, they just want to, for example, walk again if they're a lower body amputee, when maybe that's not the goal or desire of an individual. And so that's another major theme in the book, is that there is an assumption by individuals who are not in the disability community that the goal or the aim of anyone is to look like a quote-unquote able-bodied, or the norm, or the typical human body. That is what everyone would want, when it's not necessarily the case. To begin with, even the notion that, let's say, if you are going to get a prosthetic hand, first, you might not even want a prosthetic hand, that's the first choice, but secondly, that you would want it to look like a human hand, that's an assumption that might not be the case. As I was reading the book, I thought about how the human body is this incredible biological organism. It really is fascinating, incredible, does so many things that allow us to have the life and experiences that we have. But it's by no means a perfect specimen or model, that if you were building a body, would you build it the way it is? I forgot which book it was, but the book on evolution I discussed a few months ago was talking about how many aspects of the human body, because of evolution and how we evolved in the ancestors that we evolved from, were not made to stand upright and to be even out of water, and certain other factors that you wouldn't build the body to be the way that it is if you were building it from scratch, or you could just build a body on your own. So why should we assume that that is in some ways the optimal form, or if you were going to get a prosthetic or get some kind of assistance in some way, that it should be like the human body? And one, that's an assumption, and probably even relates to some aspect of human exceptionalism, but also the bias towards making everyone fit a certain norm or standard, which is very problematic, that there is a way to be, and we should try to make everyone that way. And I really thought it was a powerful quote or excerpt she shared from Rosemary Garland Thompson, talking about prosthetic hands and or functional prosthetic hands. And the way she put it is that the functional prosthetic hands that are made, they should answer the needs of the wearer instead of answering the needs of the starer, meaning the people who are looking. And I think that really powerfully captured this notion that when we are making any kind of technological advancement for anyone, it should be meeting the needs of that individual rather than making sure everyone who's looking or is observing or interacts with an individual who has that, let's say, prosthetic in this case, feels more comfortable with it, or it's the way they would want it to look. So I really thought that was a powerful way. Of course, the rhymes sometimes give it more of a punch. Answer the needs of the wearer, the person who is going to use the hand, rather than answer the needs of the starer to make others more comfortable. And this is another theme throughout the book, that when we look at prosthetics in general or other advancements that are made, it's often with this notion in mind that the way to be is the typical way, or the quote-unquote some kind of norm that everyone should try to fit and to be in that way. So I thought that was very powerful. But also in this chapter of prosthetics, and the author herself, Ashley Hsu, talks about her own experience of having to, through cancer and her treatment, have an amputation, and then to be fitted with a prosthetic leg. It's not so easy or smooth as people who have not experienced it would think. Of course, I still don't know, but hearing her account and sharing what others go through, that is a very lengthy process involving many steps and appointments and trial and error and trying this and that and the sockets, and how things fit. There's a lot of things to consider that might be very, very painful, uncomfortable, and for reasons related to that might make an individual think it's not worth it. And so again, it goes back to this notion that, well, shouldn't an individual want to have the prosthetic and to walk again or to have the functioning of what we consider the typical human body? And no, not necessarily. There can be so many costs associated with it for the individual, not to mention financial costs, that often these prosthetics cost in the 20s, 30s, even sometimes it could be $100,000 for certain types of prosthetics, and only a portion of that, I think she was saying, maybe around in the United States, 20% of that might be covered by the insurance. So there's also those financial costs on top of the physical costs and the back and forths. And also, just because someone is fit with a prosthetic doesn't mean they're set for life. The body changes, volume of the limb can change. So many things can happen. And so usually it will be true to size or true for them for a certain amount of time, and they have to be ready to then go through again another process of changes if they'd like to go through that, or appointments to change that prosthetic that they are dealing with. So after the book, I'll continue, because I didn't get to everything I wanted to discuss from the book. Highly recommended. Again, it's Against Techno-Ableism by Ashley Hsu. Let's talk more about it after the break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Continuing the discussion on the book Against Techno-Ableism by Ashley Hsu, Rethinking Who Needs Improvement. And even that, the subtitle is very meaningful and worth noting, that disability, the way it's often conceived or conceptualized, relates to the ability to do work and be a quote-unquote productive citizen in a capitalistic society. It wasn't always the case, and it's not like that in all societies and cultures, but it definitely is in Western culture and society, and it doesn't have to be that way. And one of the things I think of sometimes when we look at advancements of technology, not specifically those geared towards individuals with disabilities, but just general advancement and things like AI and how it will take jobs, and it definitely will change the labor market, already has and will continue to do so. But one of the things I hope for, and again, saying this as someone who has not been in the disability community to understand the needs and wants of the individuals within that community, but one thing that comes to mind, and I've read from others as well, is that with some of these advancements, and some jobs won't be needed or necessary in the same way, or won't require human labor or human time and effort, I would hope we would go towards helping one another, helping meeting the needs of individuals that might need or benefit from more human interaction and care. So I say that very speculatively and with all due respect, that I know I may be very ignorant even in that notion or idea, but I've read some accounts that that can be a possibility, that often some individuals with certain types of disabilities may benefit from that type of a human interaction as far as certain needs being met or assisted with. And there is often a shortage of individuals who are providing that type of care or support. And if we're going to be taking care of everyone, which we have the power to do or the ability to do, and with hopefully advancements in other types of technology, we will come back to taking care of one another the way we can, or I hope we would do. But disability is often viewed through this lens of being part of a capitalistic culture, or being productive in what is considered, or how things are considered productive or having value. And we see that expressed in many ways. In the book early on, she talks about portrayals in media and five tropes that are common related to individuals with disability. And I'll go through those, and you might recognize them. And we see the portrayals. They're first of all very limited, and they tend to fit certain narratives. So here are the five tropes that she outlines here in the book. The first one is pitiable freaks, and she says this even goes back to the history of freak shows or medical displays as well. But the individual with a disability being presented as a pitiable freak, of course, incredibly negative one. And here she cites also the Muscular Dystrophy Association. And maybe you heard of Jerry's Kids. I think when I was a kid, I would see some of these telethons, and also you hear people talk about it later on. But this is actually where the term a poster child comes from the kids that were used essentially to raise money through these telethons, and often in a very detached way from the experiences of those kids or individuals with muscular dystrophy. And so the Muscular Dystrophy Association has gotten a negative backlash based on how it used certain individuals and what it did from the disability community. And also I'll talk about Autism Speaks, which she mentions in the book, another organization that it appears to aim, or that it is trying to say it's aiming to help individuals with autism, but people within the community don't feel that way. So I'll get to that one later. So the first trope that we see often in the media is pitiable freaks. Then there's the moochers and fakers. And so often we see these types of portrayals that people who are disabled or in part of the disability community are moochers, trying to just not try hard or not contribute and just take, which is a very negative spin, of course. And then also fakers, that there's people that are pretending to be disabled in order to get benefits. And of course, it doesn't mean these things don't happen, because then people might think of stories they know of an individual who's done those things. But for this to become considered a, not a norm, but common, then is of course very harmful. And as she describes, it's not easy to get benefits for disabilities. It's not like you just ask and you get them, especially here in the United States. So many people with genuine disabilities don't get the benefits that they deserve. So this is a highly negative trope, the moochers and fakers. The next one she discusses is bitter cripples, and she gives the example of Lieutenant Dan in Forrest Gump, and Captain Hook and Peter Pan. You might remember Lieutenant Dan, who Forrest Gump serves with in the Army, and then he, through the war, becomes an amputee, and then we see him as very bitter, older individual. And so there's this trope of the bitter cripple. And also it relates to this notion that, you know, you should just have a positive attitude no matter what you're going through. You should have a positive attitude, or there's the kind of the line, the only disability is a negative attitude or a bad attitude, something like that, which is trivializing the experiences of individuals who are going through the experience of disability. The fourth one is shameful sinners. And I've heard this before. Sometimes you'll see in religious communities this thought that, oh, the person themselves or maybe their parents or an ancestor did something bad or sinful, and that's why the child now has a disability, or the individual themselves did something, or in a past life did something, or she shares how there was a refrigerator mother theory of autism, where moms were being blamed for their children being autistic, that there was something that they directly did, or that they were too cold, that they became this way. And the fifth one sounds like a positive one, but leads to negative manifestations. It's the inspirational overcomers. And this is, sometimes we'll see that, you know, so many videos like this, we can call them inspiration porn, that she mentions that term, of the individuals who have overcome their disability. And again, actually here, she puts that quote, the only disability in life is a bad attitude. And so it implies that there are quote unquote good disabled people who are constantly fighting to be and overcome their disability to be quote unquote normal or typical bodied, and they do it with a positive attitude and a smile on their face. And again, this then comes with the notion that if you're struggling with it or showing that you're not just enjoying going through with a smile on your face, that you're a bad individual with a disability, or also that your aim is to become like the typical individual or what's considered a non-disabled body, and that should be your goal, and everyone else you know, is not trying hard enough or doesn't care enough or has a bad attitude. So these are very harmful tropes that we see in the media. There was a whole chapter on neurodivergence, which as a psychologist, of course, I was interested in. I would say, unfortunately, I learned some things, because there was some things that were sad to hear and read about that I was not aware of in this chapter. But she talks about neurodivergence, even looking at those terms, neurodiversity being about the aggregate. So you can't have an individual who is neurodiverse. That has to be in a group. But then neurodivergence being about the individual. So you have these different ways of thinking, of feeling. And as she describes neurodivergence, although the term might be new or newer to many people, it's just describing something that was always there, which is that people don't all think the same or have different ways of thinking, different tendencies, different strengths and weaknesses in how they think and feel and do things. So we just now have terms for it, but there's definitely a community that is built of individuals who experience neurodiversity, including individuals with autism, ADHD, and other individuals who think that we have to be also going back to this social model, aware that the world has not been built for everyone to be included. And so we tend to think of disability as the person being the problem. We can think of, okay, the stereotypical, the child who won't sit still, and we think that child is the problem and has ADHD, rather than, well, maybe 5-year-olds are not all 5-year-olds can sit still or should sit still for an hour straight. And maybe that's not the problem of the child, it's a problem of the system that is expecting that. I learned something that I did not know, which was that the first people put into the gas chambers by Nazis before the 6 million Jews who would be slaughtered were part of the T4 program that targeted disabled people. That's a direct quote, or I hope close to direct quote from the book. I did not know that. And so that was heartbreaking and horrific, but also relates to the ways that individuals have been viewed historically with disabilities, but that does not completely go away, or we still see that notion alive today and seen today as well. But as I mentioned, Autism Speaks, which is, I think I've seen them before, an organization that says they're promoting autism rights and awareness, but she shares how individuals with autism are very much against this group or this organization because they see them as being not seeing the autistic individuals themselves, but seeing the people around them. So, for example, it's about the families and what they go through having a child with autism rather than experiences of the individuals with autism themselves. So they've got a lot of bad reactions and responses from individuals within the community who think that they are trying to act like they're for them, but really without including them and working in ways that they feel are actually against them. So I did not know that. Again, you might see a group that seems to be promoting or trying to help or be an ally of a certain group of individuals, but it might turn out that is not the case, something that I did not know about. And related to that, this was also, for me, eye-opening that there's ABA therapy, which is the most commonly that I've heard of therapy that is used for individuals with autism. And often the intervention started at a very young age, and it's supposed to be very helpful. I always had heard it was the gold standard. I myself went to UCLA, where I think it's, Ivar Lovaas. I remember that name, Lovaas, hearing that a lot, which I'll get to. But ABA is Applied Behavioral Analysis, which is an approach that uses reinforcement, also punishment, but they were aversive responses as well, to try to maybe shape, sounds like a nicer word, but change the behavior of individuals with autism starting at very young ages, again, to make them fit more a norm rather than seeing them as a whole child. And so the part that was for me eye-opening in a negative way was that I did not know that ABA was experienced as so negatively within individuals in the autism community. And so Lovaas was I remember hearing that name when I was at UCLA. I never took his class, but I actually think my brother Parham took a class or was in a class, if it was not taught by him, but where they were teaching about the therapy, but it was shown as this wonderful thing, this great thing. And from what I remembered, this was around in the early 2000s, UCLA was very proud of him and the work. Again, I don't know enough to say the full spectrum of what he contributed, but from what I saw in the book, I was a little bit shocked because I didn't know all of this. But that ABA, the punishments at times involved electric shocks, and even there were stories of a child who died from those electric shocks, and that it was, again, not taking the individual with autism into account, trying to take away behaviors. You know, when we think of self-injurious behaviors, I think, okay, that I would hope makes sense to stop. But sometimes there's things like stereotypical movements, or they call it stimming or flapping of hands, that you might see with some individuals who have autism. And what was often done, or is often done in ABA, is trying to take these behaviors away. But as was expressed in the book, using different people's descriptions of what they went through, individuals with autism themselves, this is often ways that they will soothe themselves or calm themselves or express themselves that are being taken away. And so, again, we see this notion that it's not about the individual, it's about the people having to interact, or that do interact with that person. So maybe people don't want to see the flapping hands or the stimming that the person is doing, and so we want them to stop because it makes us feel uncomfortable, rather than maybe that's their way of expressing, of experiencing, of just being themselves, and that should be okay. So that was very, as I said, eye-opening in a way that I really have to reflect on more, because I was not aware of all that was brought up in the book about that. I'm glad I read it to be aware of it, to know that. But I was not aware of that. Again, if you had asked me probably a week ago, I would have said, yeah, ABA is a good treatment for autism. But now, of course, this has changed my perspective and will lead me to have to read more about it to understand this even better. So that was a shocking for me, but I'm glad I know more about that. And again, it comes back to this whole notion that also when it comes to treatments, you know, sometimes we think of technology just as high-tech type of things, but that also includes treatments that we use that might even be talk therapy or different types of therapy, that we always want to make sure the individuals we are treating or developing a treatment for, developing whatever technology for, those individuals are front and center in the understanding and development of that technology. And even at times, the notion that we need to make an improvement in this individual, as the subtitle of the book says, the rethinking who needs improvement. Sometimes we think, well, this must be a benefit, or this must be what the person wants, but it might not be. So again, we need the individual who's experiencing whatever it is that we're looking at to be very much the one informing whoever is trying to create the technologies, even if there needs to be something created or what would be beneficial, rather than assuming and making those advancements without them involved. So very fascinating read, learned a lot, heartbreaking at times to see what the current state of things are, but in that way inspiring of hopefully what we will move toward. So again, the book is Against Techno-Ableism, Rethinking Who Needs Improvement by Ashley Hsu. Let's go to our last commercial break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. So, as I mentioned at the start of the show, covering two books tonight. The other book is The Gambler by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky, one of the greatest writers of all time, great Russian writer. And I had heard some interesting things about this book, The Gambler, and wanted to check it out. And lots of drama in the book. The main character, it seems to be autobiographical to an extent, is a tutor to a Russian general. And I say autobiographical because I did not know this until reading this book and reading a bit about it, that Dostoevsky himself was had a bad gambling habit and bad experiences gambling, where he lost a lot of money throughout his life. And so the book is in that way autobiographical. And I won't even get into the plot itself. There's the general that I mentioned. He wants to marry this younger woman, and waiting to see if his own mother dies, because then he would get a fortune and inheritance. But then the mother shows up at the casino where they are, the city where they are, and gambles a good amount of her money away. And so there's all this drama that unfolds. But what I thought was really fascinating about the book was the psychological experience of gambling and the ways that we are so good at fooling ourselves in the ways that we gamble, and that type of psychological gymnastics that we can play to lead to our own destruction in order to enjoy or experience the excitement that can come about with gambling. You know, life is uncertain, and there is a certain excitement about going into that uncertainty at times. And even what we see happening in gambling is that uncertainty makes people think that they can have some control over it. You see so many people when it comes to playing games of chance, even though if you ask many of them, they know it's random or it's a game of chance or they can't control it, or, you know, let's say you're rolling dice or it's a roulette wheel. Roulette is the main game played in this book. The numbers come up at random and you don't have any control over it. But people have systems, and you hear that in the book, where, you know, okay, I have this system of how I'm going to play, and somehow, you know, that means I will win, I'm going to beat the house, when we know that's not true. The casinos aren't charities, and so they've made the odds in a way where whatever you do and however you play, over time you will lose, because if they're paying you 35-1, you should just know that the chances of that thing happening are less than 35-1. Or 1 in 35. So, for example, in roulette, the classic thing, I think they pay you 36-1 and 36 numbers, but then there's usually at least one, if not two, green zeros, which means that if either of those come up, you don't win. And actually, I think now there's sometimes they add another one, makes it even less likely to win. So even if you bet red and black, which is feels like 50-50, it's not quite 50-50, so over time you lose, and they pay you I guess they call that 1-1, because they pay you your money back. So if you bet $10, you get $10 on top of that, you end up with 20. So there is no system, let's say if you're playing roulette, that if you play it this way, you will win. But people feel that way, or they think they're going to figure out how to crack the code, how to beat the house, so to speak. There's also this sense that for some reason, I'm lucky. You know, this, it's an interesting one. I think I'm going to win. And you hear that a few times, a few different people in the book will say they just had this feeling they were going to win, which is, again, a trick we play on ourselves, because, of course, we want to play. We think it's fun to play, to have that excitement. Gambling is exciting in the sense that it feels good, but just like cocaine feels good, it doesn't mean it's good for us, especially in any kind of long term, or that it actually is beneficial for us. Gambling will feel good, and we're very good at getting ourselves to do the things that feel good, to make them somehow okay, or even not even just okay, but better than okay. This is something I should be doing. And so I would be wasteful if I didn't play, because I'm going to definitely win. So I should push myself to play, or get myself to play the game. So you hear that a few times, and also probably relates to our, you know, we talk about narcissism as, for example, a personality disorder, but there's a certain experience of narcissism in the sense that we are experiencing our own experience. We have to be within ourselves. And so we can go to some dangerous places because of that, because we think of ourselves as somehow exceptional or different or chosen in certain ways. I think that's why we love books and movies and stories where there's a chosen one. And so often you see that, for example, in Star Wars or in other types of stories where there's a chosen one. I think internally we all want to be the chosen one. Somehow we're special, inherently different. That makes us stand out. It makes it so that we'll always belong. It'll make it so that we will be all the love and attention that we want will always be there for us. So we have this tendency to go there, and then we see it show up often in gambling, that I know it's, you know, they might say it's a game of chance, but I just feel like I feel lucky. And really, to me, I feel lucky is I feel nervous and excited, which is how you're going to feel if you're going to gamble. And I want it to be that way. I want to be lucky, but there's no, you're not lucky. Everyone is, you know, the luck evens out at the end. You know, and I've heard people say, well, if this person won the lottery, they must have been lucky. It's like, no, well, it's just random. And one person or one number or set of numbers gets chosen, and someone will have that. But doesn't mean they're lucky. You know, it's just like if we had a coin flipping contest where you weren't even flipping the coins, just the machine, let's say, was flipping the coins between, let's say, I don't know, 50 people or 64 people. And I don't know what the odds are, but whoever wins that contest for all those heads to flip a certain way, you know, there had to have been a certain percentage of things go a certain way. But it doesn't mean they're lucky or they're good at it. It's just the way it is. Someone has to win this coin flipping contest. That's just inevitable. And so similarly with gambling, we have this sense that we're going to win. Also, there's this theme comes of winning it back. You know, it's related to loss aversion, how much we hate to lose, that when we lose, it stands out more than when we win, whether we're talking about stocks or if you're selling a home and you're looking at the profits versus the losses. We hate to lock in a loss. And so when we lose, and you see this happening, that the gambler's chasing the money back. Okay, I lost the $100, I'm going to win it back. And they keep going. Well, now I've lost $200, I have to win that back. And it could feel like this compulsion to get back the money that they've lost. But unfortunately, this will usually lead to losing even more and more to the point of where they can't win back, where they won't have money left, where they've lost much more than they would have wanted. So we see that happen a lot, this feeling of this, the system is there. Another thing we see a lot in gambling is this looking for patterns. Now, this is all assuming things are fair. So if the dice are loaded or if the roulette wheel has, you know, the house is doing something fishy and unfair and making certain numbers come up more often, yes, then all bets are off, pun intended. But if we're talking about a fair roulette wheel or a fair pair of dice, the odds are the odds. So you can't make a system that works. And also, you can't say, well, red came up, so black should come up next. When we look at the law of large numbers, if you're looking at the roulette wheel, what might look like crazy patterns can occur because it's a random each time. So because black came last time doesn't mean red will come up this time more likely. It is random. People are looking for patterns. Again, when things are out of our control, we try to look for things that make them controlled. It's similar to superstitions with everything. It happens definitely in gambling, having a lucky the rabbit's foot or blow on the dice for luck or do this for luck. It's the same thing we see when we're watching sports, where we can't control the outcome. We want something to happen so bad that we are looking for anything that might be making the difference, or we think it's making the difference. You know, like, okay, well, you were sitting in that chair when our team was winning and then you changed seats and they lost. Go back to that chair because that's the lucky chair. Of course, it had nothing to do with it. But when we care a lot about things and they feel out of our control, we try to find a way to think we're having some semblance of control. This also relates to life in general, where we don't have control, we're looking for it, we want it, and we somehow sometimes come up with these artificial ways to get control. Even we see this in animals, where if they're being punished or reinforced in what is random ways, they seem to then produce what looks like superstitious behavior because they do things that aren't related to getting getting the reward or avoiding the punishment, but they think it's there. They're trying to control it. We might think, oh, that's so silly. That's what the animals are doing, but us humans, we're doing it all the time. We're trying to create ways or come up with ways to control things that actually have no impact on what is going on, but it makes us feel like we're in control. So if you have a lucky cup or a lucky socks that you wear. I'm wearing Lakers socks as we speak. There's a Lakers game going on as I'm recording the show. I'm trying not to check the score. So I didn't even think of that till I was saying this. But yeah, I'm wearing my Lakers socks. I don't think it's going to affect the outcome. But I'm just wearing them in support. But, you know, we think we're controlling things or have some way of controlling, but we actually don't. And I thought the book was interesting going to that psychological a perspective of the gambler, the excitement, the compulsion, the high of winning, the despair of losing, of trying to chase that win again, the feeling of inevitably I'm going to win, which is a magical thinking that we can get. All of those were quite fascinating and expressed quite illustratively in this book. So a really interesting read, as to be expected from one of the great writers in history, Dostoevsky. That is, again, the book, The Gambler. All right, that brings us to the end of tonight's show. Big thank you to Farhuda here in the studio. You've been listening to In Session with Dr. Farid Olakwi. Zan Zendegi Azadi.